Let's turn to the book of Hebrews, chapter 2. This morning we begin a new series and we entitle it Overcoming Fear. Hebrews chapter 2, verse 14. The reason why we are teaching on overcoming fear is because we realize that fear is the main force that the devil uses, and it's an emotion and as well as a spiritual attribute that the devil plays upon. And there are many types of fear, and we will deal with each one of them one at a time. And we pray that God will help each one of us overcome various types and areas of fear in our life. Hebrews chapter 2, verse 14 and verse 15. Inasmuch then as the children have partaken of flesh and blood, he himself likewise shared in the same, that through death he might destroy him who had the power of death, that is, the devil, and release those who through fear of death were all their lifetime subject to bondage. Here tells us that the devil uses the instrument of fear, and in this particular case, the fear of death, to hold all human beings under bondage. Not only the fear of death, but all other forms of fear produces bondage. And unless we overcome fear in our life, we will continually be bound or our hands tied up by fear. Whether it be a fear of heights, fear of creatures, or all types of fear, they will hold us in bondage, and we cannot really be the kind or type of person that God wants us to be. Apparently, Jesus completely has no fear at all. If you were to check the Webster's Dictionary on the definition of fear, the Webster's defines fear as a strong emotion associated with the awareness or the presence of danger. It's a strong emotion that is associated with the awareness or the presence of danger. Then the other definition it gives you is, it is the feeling of awesomeness before God. So it gives you two separate types of definition. One is a positive area, one is a negative area. But as we examine the Bible, there are different types or areas of fear. And we will define it differently. First of all, fear is the absence of something. An absence, whether of light, of knowledge, or an absence of faith automatically produces fear. Just like darkness is the absence of light. Everywhere where light is absent, automatically there is darkness. So fear is the absence of a positive force. It's the absence of light, God's divine light, the absence of knowledge, the absence of whatsoever. Fear is an absence of something. Fear is an absence of a lack in our own soul, a lack in our own training, or whatsoever. There is a lack of something, and it causes fear. The second area of fear that we want to define is where fear is a presence of a wrong principle or wrong knowledge or wrong perception. Now it's different. Now fear becomes something present. But the something present is not the truth. So fear also can be defined as the presence of a lie, an untruth, whether it be a principle, it be knowledge, etc. And if we are told a lie, it can cause fear. But if we were not told anything, in the first place, we may not have fear in that area. For example, as you are going to the beach, somebody lied to you and said, there are sharks in this place. What has happened? Before you were told you didn't have the fear, after you were told, you have the fear. But let's go to the same beach, and you have never learned swimming before. You see the waves rolling, and due to the lack of training, the absence of something, and the lack of experience of being in the water, in the waves, you also have a fear. But we define the two fears differently. Fear is the absence of something, fear is the presence of something. The absence of knowledge, the absence of light. The other is the fear, is the presence of an untruth. The third area of fear is fear is a spiritual attribute that issues forth from Satan and his cohorts. Fear becomes an attribute. It's a spiritual force. In the first two definitions, it's not a spiritual force. It has to do with knowledge. But the third definition, it's a spiritual force. And that all these three that we define differently, we do not define the other one where we talk about the fear of God, that we will talk towards the end of this series. But we want to teach on overcoming fear. That is why we have to define what fear is. And there are many areas or types of fear. So we will classify them one by one. The first area of fear or type of fear has to do with what I call childhood fears. Childhood fears. Now, childhood fears, if they are not dealt with, will come into our adult life and become a part of our personality. It is not originally a part of our personality, but through the wrong input, which again goes back to the second definition, or through the absence or lack of training and knowledge, it comes into our life. So childhood fears are defined by the first two definitions. It's the lack of something or presence of the wrong thing. But childhood fears can be classified into different areas and different types. We are not dealing with the spirit of fear yet. That will come later. We are just dealing with childhood fears that come into adult life. And if we have not faced it, have not dealt with those things in our life, it will continue to haunt our lives as adults. It will prevent you from being successful. It will prevent you from manifesting your best. Always you're giving second rate and second best. Or in fact, the worst. We know how paralyzing fear can be. What are some childhood fears? Number one, rejection. A child fears rejection. For a child is helpless on its own, on the street. A child is left to itself, doesn't know anything about this life. So a child fears rejection. And if that fear of rejection is not dealt with, it creeps into our adult life. And we have a constant underlying subconscious fear that stifle the true personality of our being. The childhood fear of rejection comes about because every child is born with the capacity to be loved. Every child is born to receive love from somebody. And if that love is not given by our parents, we seek that acceptance and love from our friends. And if that love is not given by our friends, then we become a perverted, twisted personality who looks like an outcast of society. It has to be dealt with. The fear of rejection eats up a person's boldness. Eats up a person's initiative to do something. Because of the fear of failure, where the world will laugh at us, we lose our initiative. And many opportunities pass us in life, we're just missing it. We will look in the Bible at a person who did not deal with his childhood fears, and later on when he became seemingly a success as an adult, that fear destroyed him. Your childhood fears can destroy your adult successes. The fear of rejection is basically a desire to be accepted. A desire to be loved. It sometimes comes out in a different way as a desire to be recognized. A desire to be honored. A desire where people would pay attention to you. All these are perverted forms of the fear of rejection. And Jesus cannot use a witness who is like that. You know how sometimes people want attention, children want attention, all these things. These are twisted ways of the fear of rejection. But we clog it differently as an adult. Many adults desire to be recognized, to be honored. Basically, it's the fear of being rejected that has not been dealt with. In the book of 1 Samuel, all childhood fears relate to the environment or to people. When a child is rejected by a person, like their parents, they find it hard to deal with other people. So childhood fears relate to the child's ability to relate to people. And the first person, the child's life is his own parents or his own guardians. In the book of 1 Samuel, chapter 10, 1 Samuel chapter 10, the occasion is Samuel introducing Saul, the king, to the whole of the Israelites. And Samuel came in verse 20 and caused all the tribes of Israel to come near. The tribe of Benjamin was chosen. When he had caused the tribe of Benjamin to come near by their families, the family of Matri was chosen, and Saul the son of Kish was chosen, and when they sought him, he could not be found. Therefore they inquired of the Lord further, "Has the man come here yet?" And the Lord answered, "There he is hidden among the equipment." So they ran and brought him from there, and when he stood among the people, he was taller than any other people from his shoulders upward. And Samuel said to all the people, "Do you see him whom the Lord has chosen? There is no one like him among all the people." So all the people shouted and said, "Long live the king." What a great start to King Saul's career. But from the beginning of his career, there was a small little symptom of the fear of rejection. There came a time when they were going to honor and present the king, the inauguration. And during that time, as Samuel was going to present the king, Saul, because of the fear of rejection, the fear of rejection of people, it's interesting to see how the fear of rejection, which is actually the desire to be accepted, becomes a desire to be alone and hidden. The very opposite. The desire and the need for acceptance becomes a fear of rejection, and then becomes a desire to be alone and hidden. What an opposite way fear can operate. Why? Because it is better not to be rejected than to be rejected, and therefore the reasoning is, let me not put myself in a situation where I may be rejected. And originally it's a fear. But at the base of it is the desire to be accepted. So fear can actually make a person do the very opposite of what they actually need. And there's this small symptom that is coming out in Saul's life, and he has never dealt with that. And he managed to pull through that. But later on in chapter 13, verse 1, Saul reigned 1 year. And when he had reigned 2 years over Israel, Saul was successful for 2 years. He reigned over the whole of Israel until one day there was a battle coming up. And he waited in verse 8 for 7 days for Samuel. And Samuel didn't turn up, and he offered a burnt sacrifice. Just at the moment when he offered a burnt sacrifice, Samuel appeared, and in verse 11, Samuel said, "What have you done?" And Saul said, "When I saw that the people were scattered from me, and that you did not come within the days appointed, and that the Philistines gathered together a meek mesh, then I said, the Philistines will now come down on me at Gilgal, and I have not made supplication to the Lord. Therefore I felt compelled and offered a burnt offering." And Samuel said, "You have done foolishly. Because of this, the Lord will not be able to let," in verse 14, "your kingdom continue." Basically, in verse 11, Saul said, "When I saw the people scattering because of the delay, when I saw the people running away, in your delay in coming within 7 days, I forced myself to do something which was against God's command so that the people won't go away." The fear of rejection produces two extremes. One extreme is to avoid people. Avoid people lest you be rejected. See, childhood fears relate to other human beings. The other extreme is to please people. To do anything under the sun by hook and by crook so that they will never reject you. These two extremes change a person's personality to be different from the way God made them to be. I repeat again, a fear of rejection produces two extremes. One is the antisocial guy. The other is the Mr. Please Everybody, by hook and by crook. Do anything under the sun just so that they will accept you. If they want you to wear a polka dot shirt and tie looking like a clown, you also do it so that you get accepted. In whatever conform, the way you could conform. Peer pressure. So these two extremes are playing on Saul's life. He moved from one extreme, the antisocial guy wanting privacy and not wanting people to say anything, do anything, let it be heard, to the other extreme of, well, since I'm now in the limelight, let me do everything in case the people reject me. He is afraid. All the time operating in fear. That fear finally destroyed him. In another incident that finally destroyed him, is in 1 Samuel chapter 15. 1 Samuel 15. The incident is Saul keeping the animals of the Amalekites and sparing certain people, the Amalekites, in disobedience to God's command. And when Samuel rebuked Saul, this was Saul's statement in verse 24. Then Saul said to Samuel, I have sinned, for I have transgressed the commandment of the Lord and your words, because I feared the people and obeyed their voice. You see, the extreme of the fear of rejection, the fear of rejection is ultimately the fear of people. Saul said, I was afraid of what, of these people. Now, he was not afraid of the people destroying him. He was afraid of the people rejecting him. He was afraid that if he didn't listen to these people won't honor him and accept him as king, forgetting that it was God who made him king and not the people. I could imagine the situation as Saul was going out to battle, and he fought and won against these Amalekites. And as he was fighting, some of these generals or his or some of the other people said, Saul, why not we keep all these animal sacrifices and spare these people? We could not use them as slaves, etc. Saul was caught in a situation. God said to wipe them out. The people said, spare them because they have use for us. He was caught in that situation where if he had no fear of rejection in his life, he would say, no, God said it, let's do it God's way. He would not be afraid of telling the people as God says, whether the people accept him or not. But because of his fear of rejection from his childhood, he was afraid if he said no to these people, that these people will reject him. He could not take a no from the people. That's a fear of rejection. The reason why we go to some details so that you could recognize some of these fears. They are clothed in many, many types of garments. The inability to say no to a person is also the fear of rejection. If you are someone who cannot say no to others, where principles are concerned, you have a fear of rejection. If you are going around saying, yeah, alright. You look like a jolly good fellow. But behind it, cloth by the plastic mask, is the fear of rejection. See, a stable person should be able to say yes to yes things, no to no things. If out of your mouth and personality, all that comes out is either a yes, 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 or no, 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 only in the two extremes, then you have a fear of rejection. It moves you again to the two extremes. You are against the people and hide from them, or you want to please them all the time. Two vital extremes. What are some of the signs of this coming out in a child? What is the root of these things? How do we deal with the fear of rejection? That we have to trace Saul's early statements before he became king. And we could recognize these symptoms coming out and deal with them and find a solution. In 1 Samuel chapter 9, in the first encounter of Saul with Samuel, you see the root of the fear of rejection, which produces the two extremes. The extreme of pleasing man or the extreme of hiding away from people. The root of this rejection, shyness, is actually the polite way of clothing the fear of rejection. I'm shy. It's a nice word for fear. That deals with almost all of us. 1 Samuel chapter 9. So Saul, as he was coming, looking for the donkeys, in verse 6, his servant said, "Look now, there is in this city a man of God, and he is an honorable man. All that he says surely come to pass, so let us go there, perhaps he can show us the way that we should go." Then Saul said to his servant, "But look, if we go, what shall we bring the man? For the bread in our vessels is all gone, and there is no present to bring to the man of God. What do we have?" Do you notice Saul's reaction in his first meeting of this man of God? He is quite unsure himself. He says, "What shall we bring for this person? What shall we do to this person?" Can you see the seed of the King Saul who said, "I was afraid that these people were scattered, so I did the sacrifice. I was afraid of what these people said to me, so I kept the sacrifices and spared King Agag of the Amalekites." See, these are what he did in adult life when he was a successful king. But before that, you notice this, even before he approached one man, just one man, who at that time happened to be a famous person, Samuel the prophet and the priest. In just approaching that one man, Saul was very unsure of himself. How shall I come to him? I don't have a present. Where in the world did he get the idea that you must have a present to meet a man of God? Where did he get the idea that when you approach somebody, you must always have a present? Who taught him? Who told him? The Bible never said, whenever you approach a prophet or a priest, bring a present. Never said that. Where did this idea come from? Come to him? It's the basic root of saying, "I must do something to get people to accept me. I must do something to get people to accept me. So before I come to this man, God, in case he rejects me, let me get a backup plan. Before he rejects me, I do something so that he can never reject me." Now, of course, if you're giving presents to people, you give it out of love, not out of fear of rejection. But outwardly, it looks the same. We pray that when people give presents, it's not out of fear. If I don't give you a present, you do this to me. If I don't give you a present, you're not going to be nice to me. Outwardly, it's the same present. But inwardly, the present is motivated differently. Because when you give presents or you want to show gifts, you do it because of the love that you have for the recipient, not because of anything else. But you could see this working in him. Small, tiny little seed that grew into a big plant and destroyed his entire kingship, entire kingdom, entire ministry. Your whole business can be destroyed because of fear from your childhood. That little seed that is not dealt with can grow to a mighty plant and destroy your entire family, and destroy your entire business, destroy your entire ministry. If it's not dealt with. So Saul said in verse 7, "I don't have anything to bring to him. What shall I do?" And look at verse 8, the servant went along with him. "Look, we got this money we can give to him. We got love offering, 1/4 of a shekel of silver. So we bring this love offering to him." This is what I call intelligent fear of rejection. What is intelligent fear of rejection? Before rejected, plan a plan to anticipate the rejection and then win the person over before the possibility of rejection comes. It's a very intelligent approach. In other words, it's just like lovers who are about to make the first move. A likes B, B likes A, but A doesn't know that B likes A, and B doesn't know that A likes B. A usually is a man. So A wants to find out. And so it goes every way possible to find out He creates and He does a lot of things, and what I call the build-up. Builds up the relationship, builds to the point when finally it reaches a point as so that the person finds it harder to say no. But the person, of course, still can say no. No girl will just marry just for the present. Right? Very silent here. I know out there in the world, some people marry just for the money. And I'm reminded of a young man who was in his 20s who married an old granny about 60 over year old. The only difference was the granny was a millionaire. So some people thought, obviously, he must have been married just for the money, hoping that she died very quickly. Lo and behold, she lived up to about 100 plus. By that time, he was in his 50s. So, that's some of the things that happen out there in the world. But no true Christian blooded girl or boy will marry just for that. But yet, what is all these things about presence and all these things, building up the situation, even before there was a commitment? Because a person is building to the point where it's harder to say no. Or showing love. Do you notice nobody would just approach a stranger and say, "Would you marry me?" They never. Why? It's too strong. So they test the ground. They don't mind a small rejection compared to a big rejection. So what do? They send a small little card. Then they see the reaction. Right? If after that the person avoids them, then they know, rejected. So it's a small little rejection. They will not send over. I know some crazy guys who said, you know, let me present you with a car. Say, what does he think? That you can win love by things? But that's what people do as they approach because they are afraid of rejection. So they move very cautiously. Very, very cautiously. And here, Saul, in verse 8, chapter 9, verse 8, brought a small little present so that before the man of God could reject him, he anticipated the rejection and he moved accordingly. It's a very intelligent maneuver, but it's the same fear. Then when the man of God accepted him, surprisingly, in chapter 9, verse 17, when Samuel saw Saul, the Lord said to him, "There he is, the man of whom I spoke to you, this one shall reign over my people." Then Saul drew near to Samuel in the gate and said, "Please tell me where is the seer's house?" Verse 19. Samuel answered Saul and said, "I am the seer." What a shock it must have been. And then the seer said, "Go up before me to the high place, for you shall eat with me today, and tomorrow I will let you go. And I'll tell you all that is in your heart. But as for your donkeys that were lost 3 days ago, do not be anxious about them, for they have been found. And on whom is all the desire of Israel? Is it not on you and on all your father's house?" After all his maneuver, he never anticipated this will happen. All his scheming and his planning, hoping to just come and give a small gift to the prophet and say, "Can you tell us where is the donkey?" Before he could even give the small fourth of a silver shekel, the prophet looked at him and said, "You will eat with me, and then tomorrow I will let you go. As for your donkeys that have been found, don't worry." Now Saul is trembling. He never anticipated this kind of reception. The fear of rejection, is to be accepted. Here suddenly he's accepted. He's not only accepted by the prophet. The prophet said, you will eat with me. Welcome to my home. Saul is trembling. I want to be accepted, but I'm not sure about this. Look at Saul's reaction. And he says, verse 21, am I not a Benjamite, or the smallest of the tribe of Israel? My family, the least of all the families of the tribe is of Benjamin. Why do you speak like that to me? Why do you talk this way to me? Now what is happening here? The fear of rejection wants acceptance and love. But yet, if the fear is so long in a person, when that love is finally given, the person is suspicious. For so long you live without it, now it's given, you're very, very suspicious. Very, extremely suspicious. Not only that, Saul said, basically this is what he said. Who am I? I'm not worthy of this reception. I'm only from the smallest tribe. Who is my father? And you know who you are? You're a prophet, priest. Who am I? Who am I? I am nothing compared to you. And here we have the root of the fear of rejection and the cure for it. See, the root of the fear of rejection, part of it is to be accepted, to be loved. But if you dig out the root and examine the root, you find there's tap roots, lateral roots, and all kinds of roots. When you dig it out and you examine the root of it, you realize that the root of that fear of rejection is a lack of self-discovery. A person doesn't know themselves. And the root of it is that this person himself has not accepted his own capabilities or his own weaknesses. In other words, the worst of rejection is that in the end you reject yourself. It all started because somebody rejected you. And you accept that person's rejection into your life, so it becomes your rejection of yourself. Fear of rejection produces self-rejection. Now, self-denial and self-rejection is different. But here it produces a kind of personality where the person's soul is saying, I'm a nobody. I'm just no good. I'm just on the smallest tribe, the poorest tribe. Which are not true. Because the poorest house in Israel doesn't own donkeys. So he is not the poorest house. But when the fear of rejection has dwelt in a child or in any person's life for some time, it produces self-rejection. And the only key to unlock the fear of rejection is for that person to discover who they are in God. Self-discovery. To discover all their points and their possibilities within them. To discover the person whom God has made them to be. If you discover yourself, some people accidentally in life discover some areas in their life and overcome that rejection in their life. It could be a very mediocre person who just make average grades, and suddenly one day they realize they have a talent for sports. And then they enter into sports and they get all the applause from the people and they became famous in sports, and somehow their personality changed. They became confident. And they became, all the best in them came out. It was what I call an accidental discovery of a person's own talent that was there. And this kind of self-discovery needs to be done. But before we move into that and show a positive person who overcame that in his life and discover who he is in God, sadly it was not Saul, somebody else. We need to touch on another attribute because those two link together. The other childhood fear that is present is the fear of the unknown, or the fear of something bigger than you. All children are, a child is small. And all you have to do to create fear in a child, if it's a small little child, is there's a huge, big monster. And straight away they are afraid. By virtue of physical size, they are afraid of things that are unknown, or things that are bigger than them. Or you tell a little child, right? Don't go out in the street, which is not good upbringing. Don't go out in the street. And there is this big fellow roaming the street who captures children. And these unknown things that they haven't explored. Why are children afraid of darkness? You notice that it depends on what they watch and what they see. Before they ever see any TV, see anything on monsters, they may never be afraid of darkness. But then somehow they just had one glimpse of the possibility of dragons, snakes and monsters and ghosts. Straight away they are afraid of darkness. Therefore it may be there. Fear of the unknown. These childhood fears of the unknown basically is the fear of self-preservation. In case something happens to me physically, in case my life is threatened, in case my physical body is attacked, it is what I call self-preservation. It's the fear for your life. The fear for your life. And this childhood fear for your life can come out into an adult in a very dignified and social way. Where self-preservation can come forth through telling lies in order to preserve yourself when you're in danger, or through a compromising situation so that you could preserve yourself. And it comes out as similar symptoms to the first fear, but the root is different. Like a person may want to be alone and not have an initiative, possibly it's also because they are fearful for their own life. They are afraid of dangers. And so that fearfulness for their own life comes about. Let's see an example here. There are several examples in the Bible. And here is where we have read Hebrews 2 verse 15. That through the bondage of fear, the fear of death, the devil holds all men in bondage through the fear of death. In the book of Genesis, chapter 12, God spoke to Abraham in verse 1 to 3, and of all person Abraham, who was the father of our faith, he has to deal with his childhood fears. Get out of your country, from your kindred, and from your father's house, to a land that I will show you. I will make you a great nation. I will bless you and make your name great. And you shall be a blessing. I will bless those who bless you. I will curse those who curse you. And in you all the families of the earth shall be blessed. So Abraham was told by God, you shall get out into this unknown area. He has never been to the area of the promised land. It was all strange and unknown. Easily childhood fears can come about if it's not dealt with. Why is it that when a teenager grows up into adulthood, they are afraid of moving to a new place? The fear of a new job. The fear of an interview. The fear of things new. Why? Part of it is the fear of rejection. The other part of it, it's also the unknown. I don't know what is over there. I don't know what can be present. I know not what the future. The fear of the future. All this is the fear of the unknown. There is a childhood symptom not dealt with. And so Abraham, part of it because of the fear of the unknown, like to have something familiar around. And he took Lot along with him as a companion. Something which God told him not to do. But he took Lot along, and God did not speak to him again in that covenant promise until Lot departed from him. That was a play on his fears. Moses also had a little bit of that when he spoke to Jethro and said, "Stay here, for the wilderness is great and terrible, and we may need your eyes." In spite of the fact that he has God as a pillar of cloud by day and a pillar of fire by night, he asked for Jethro, who lived in the wilderness, to sort of be with him. These are all small childhood fears coming into adult life. But here's a verse in chapter, looking on, in chapter 12, verse 12. "Therefore," he told his wife, "it will happen when the Egyptians see you, they will say, this is your wife, this is his wife. And they will kill me, but they will let you live. Please say you are my sister, that it may be well with me for your sake, and that I may live because of you." Abraham, because of the fear of death, self-preservation, went to the extent of telling his wife to tell a lie and himself telling a lie so that he could preserve his own life. The man of faith was afraid of dying. And the devil used opportunities to play on that fear, the fear of death. The fear of death is the fear of the unknown. Why are people afraid of death? Because they don't know what happens after death. But as a Christian and as a believer, if you know what happens after death, there should be no fear anymore. As a small little boy, and as I came, when I was a new Christian, like all basic human beings, you have a fear of the supernatural. That we will talk later, but there was also this fear of demons that I've completely overcome. And one day it dawned on me that I'm a believer. What can the demons do? If you die, you go to heaven. If they hang around, what else can they do? And it dawned on me there's nothing they can do. Because, I don't know, some of you had this experience or not, but in the early days of my Christian life, sometimes when you're half awake, half asleep, you feel this demon pressing on you. And there's great fear. Until it dawned on me, what's there to be afraid of? If they are there in your bedroom, what else can they do but stare at you? If they kill you, you go to be with God. And slowly it evolved to a situation where I realized there's nothing else to fear about them. And slowly that fear has disappeared completely. I'm not afraid of them at all. But there's this inherent fear of death. Inherent fear to protect our life that the devil plays upon. Of course, Peter walking on the water in Matthew chapter 14, the devil played on his fear of death. When he saw the waves rolling, he's afraid that he'd drown. But if he had a different approach, as he walked on water, as the waves come, he said, "Die, die, no problem." He would never be moved. So what? He has told me to walk. Even if I walk and sing and die, die, then I die trusting him. But he's afraid of death. As he's walking there, these waves that come, and he's getting unsteady, he's afraid what these waves do to him. He will drown, he will drown, you will drown, you will drown, said the devil, you will drown, you will drown. And he started swimming. When he started swimming, instead of walking, he started really drowning. Jesus didn't say, "Swim here." Jesus said, come. Expected him to walk. So this fear of death has to be dealt with. This fear of death and fear of the unknown has to be dealt with. These are childhood fears. And if we have a group of disciples that are afraid of the unknown and afraid of death, they will be among the people who are like the 10 spies, afraid to go in. Do you know what the 10 spies said? These people are so big, we are like grasshoppers. What are they saying? We are afraid they'll kill us. Kill, kill! That's my attitude. If God sent you there, and if the giant kills you, kill! Then God didn't back up His word. Which will never happen. But you see, the devil used them to play on their fear. The fear of the unknown. Oh, yes, God said, the land of milk and honey. Yes, that is true. The grapes are that big. But God didn't say anything about those giants. There are giants in the land. And the giants will kill us. And we cannot taste the milk and honey. And the devil played on their fear, and the entire nation of adults were so frightened, they did not dare to go in. But the interesting thing is that when Moses said, after God said, all right, you will not go in, you will all die in the wilderness except your children, who did not have the same fear they had. All the adults organize and say, oh, now we'll go and fight. Moses said, too late. Too late. God said, no more. He won't be with you. And when they went to fight, they died. How is it that at one hand, they were willing to fight, the other hand, they were not willing to fight? Sometimes it's just like the leper situation in the time of Elisha. If we stay here, we die. If we go there, we die. You remember how the Israelites were surrounded by the Syrian army? And the lepers were outside the city wall. And the lepers said, the lepers were around the city area. And the lepers said, if we stay here, we will die. Die of starvation. If we go to the Syrian camp, they may kill us and we will also die. So here die, there die, so let's try dying there. Do you know what? Why the Israelites were willing to go and fight after that? Same reasoning. Since God said we're going to die in the wilderness now, and die, then better fight and die. But God said, don't go. Too late. You want to die, you should have been willing to die earlier. So sometimes the same reasoning. People are so fearful that they have to be motivated by a greater fear and a lesser fear. That's how people are. They are so fearful that they will not move unless a greater fear versus a lesser fear, and comparatively speaking, it's better to take the lesser. People will not move, will not change until they are forced to do it or they die. People are not adapt to change. So fearful. And they have to be moved by fear itself. So they say, the leper says, if here die, there die, let's go to the Syrians, because they got one small chance they may pity us and we may leave. And so you can imagine the lepers going out. They say the famous word, why tarry we here till we die? And so they go forth. As they went forth, they found that the camp was so quiet. All of them are not willing to die. And as they approached near the Syrian camp, they noticed there was nobody around. I don't know what they conclude. Maybe they all went on leave or something. But they took all the food they want, hid everything, and then they said, this is not right, we better tell the rest. And so they sneaked back and told the whole entire Israelite city. And when they came out, they found all the Syrians had fled. To their amazement. The fear of death is a bondage. What is the root of the fear of death? A lack of willingness to surrender our lives to a greater power. You know when man has a fear of death coming in? It's because man wants to be in control. It's just like a little child, and the whole house is on fire, and the child is on the third floor. And the parents of the child says, "Dear, jump down, we will catch you." And the child looks down at the height and says, "Wow." Looks back at the fire and says, "Wow." Now the child, if the child is to jump down, all the child can trust on for his entire life is the parents' arms. And the love of the parents and the desire of the parents for the child to live. That somebody else value their life as much as they value their life. In the end, the child is willing to jump because the child trusts the parents. And when the child jumps, whoo, under the force of gravity, for a moment of time, the child is no more in control of its own life. For a moment of time, the entire life of the child rests on somebody else, in that case, the parents. Because man has shut God out of the picture, man doesn't trust in a higher power. And because we don't trust in a higher power greater than us, who is interested in our own preservation, and we want to be in control, we find when we couldn't control, we are in great despair. So the root of it, as we begin to see, is a lack of willingness or ability to surrender our lives to a greater power, who knows our circumstances and who loves us as much as we are careful and want to live. And He wants us to live as much as we want to live. And when we are willing to surrender our lives to a greater power, we are willing, we have got rid of the fear of death. So the cure for the fear of rejection is to discover, is self-discovery. The cure for the fear of the unknown and death is self-surrender. There are different things. Self-discovery and self-surrender. A surrendered life is a bold life. When you surrender your entire life to God, you're no more afraid of death. You're no more afraid of what will happen in the future. And somebody says, "Are you afraid?" No. Because I'm not the one in control. Like the little child, I have jumped. And my life is in the hands of another person whom I have trusted my entire being. That removes fear completely. When we begin to examine the root. Now we close by looking at somebody who overcome both. His name is David. In the book of 1 Samuel, chapter 17, David was a person who was able to tolerate and accept rejection. In 1 Samuel chapter 17, as the first battle that David faced was not Goliath. It was not Goliath. The first battle David faced was rejection from his own brothers. If you cannot overcome your first battle of rejection, you cannot even have a chance to face Goliath. If you're not willing to face rejection, every business takes some measure of risk. There is no true success without risk in this life. We have to take a calculated risk in God. The venture of faith is risking your entire life in God. There is no business that has no risk. Although we try to eliminate the risk so that we are quite secure, all your investments have a measure of risk. You may say, you know, don't buy that company, you know, it's risky, you know. Now there are certain areas that are risky. Don't go into a business, it's risky. Every business has some risk. You may say, put all your savings in the bank. The banks may go bankrupt. There is also a risk. It is backed up by the government. Well, how stable are governments? Of course, we trust that in God, all are stable. But I want you to know that there is risk in everything you do. It's a measure of a greater or a lesser risk. And so here, we look at chapter 17, that the first major battle David faced was rejection. If he was someone like Saul, whom his brother scolded and said, I know why you're here. I know you came to spoil the battle, you little brat. And he would run away like a dog with a tail between the legs. My brother scolded me. And quickly pack up and go home. It would have been a different story. But in chapter 17, in verse 22, David left his supplies in the hand of the supply keeper, ran to the army and came and greeted his brothers. And in verse 26, David spoke to the man who stood by him, saying, what shall be done for the man who kills this Philistine, who takes away the reproach from Israel? For who is this uncircumcised Philistine, that he should defy the armies of the living God? And the people answered him in this manner, saying, so shall it be done for the man who kills him. Then now Eliab, his oldest brother, heard that he spoke to the man. And Eliab's anger was aroused against David. And he said, why did you come down here? And with whom have you left those few sheep in the wilderness? I know your pride and the insolence of your heart, for you come down to see the battle. He had a real good firing from his oldest elder brother. His elder brother rejected him, was not loving towards him, and did not accept him in that situation. If David had run like a dog with his tail between the legs, we would never hear of this story. He was even accused of pride. People who take risks are often accused of many things. And in chapter 17, David continued. He was not afraid. And in the end, they brought him to Saul in verse 32. Let no man's heart fail. Obviously, he was not afraid. He even said, don't any one of you be afraid. That's another way of saying, let no man's heart fail. Look at David. The whole camp is paralyzed with fear. So much fear, the Bible says in chapter 17 here, that when this Goliath came forth and challenged them in verse 11, Saul and all Israel heard these words of the Philistine. They were dismayed and greatly afraid. The entire camp, including the king, was afraid. And here is a small little David who was so small size he cannot even wear Saul's armor. He was not a big size, overgrown child. He was small in stature. When they put the armor, he was so skinny that he couldn't move. And here's this skinny, scrawny kid saying, let no man be afraid. See, how did he overcome his fear? See, David had discovered himself. The greatest discovery you ever have in your life is to discover who you are in God. When you know who you are in God and people tell you you're not who you are, you know. But when you don't know who you are in God and people tell you who you are, you believe that. So every one of us must discover who we are. No matter what your background is or what your age, God made you for a purpose. God has put some gifts and some talents and some ability in your life. Even though the world may declare you got nothing good and there's no good, what good can come out of Nazareth? What good can come out of Tanatu? You know yourself. You know Tanatu yourself because you are Tanatu. Who shall this? We must realize that the only way to overcome rejection is to know thyself and know thy tools and know thy gifts and know thy talents. Hallelujah. And you will never more be afraid of what the world says. Some of you may do some things in some area and you may have some experts come and say, it is never done this way. But if you have done your homework and you know it, you'll be willing to go on. Think about some of those people who have done something in life. The first time when they do it, some of those big, giant businesses, people come to them and say, it can never be done. But they know themselves and they know their tools and they know their product. So they say, we know it can be done. And of course, that can be dangerous. You have to really know it in God. So there is not an inflated ego, but it is a truth. A truth. How do you know it's a truth? You have tested it out. The only way to really know yourself is to test yourself. You may believe that you're the greatest ballet dancer in town. Then my suggestion is, well, if you really believe so, go into this small competition. Don't go into the world's championship of ballet dancers. Why? You may not only be last, you'll be the last of the last. If you believe you're the best badminton player in town, the best in the world, don't straight away enroll in the World Badminton Championship. Why? You have nowhere to hide your face when you get 15 minus 1. 15-0, right? At least it's better to lose 15-14 than 15-0. Three games, flat, 0-0-0. You become the famous ache. Right? If you believe that you're the world's best in whatever, start with your lions and your bears. Develop confidence. Do you know that David was confident in his tools? He know himself and he know his tools. If in the business you think that you could market your product all over this country and all you're counting is population growth, it's not good enough. Because you haven't really tested your product. And you, before you ever sold any single product, you manufactured about 1 billion pieces. Get into debt. What will happen? Prison ministry. David says, when he put on Saul's armor, I haven't tested this armor. In verse 39. He tried to walk, for he had not tested them. And David said to Saul, I cannot walk with these, for I have not tested them. So David took them off. See, you must test yourself, and you must test your tools. If you believe that you're called into the ministry to be a teacher or preacher, don't start in a convention. Start in a home group. If you believe that you have the word of knowledge operating in your life, don't start with a big campaign where you rent a hall that sees 10,000, advertise in the New Straits Times front page, last page, and center page. And you have never conducted a single meeting before. You haven't tested your gift. Test it out in a small group. And you may be unsure of yourself. You say, I believe I sense somebody has this or that. You may start that way. But it's the testing of your own gift. Why? Because if you believe somebody has a sickness and there are 15 in a home group, it's easy to find out. Ask everybody. And if everybody didn't have, then you go back and check yourself. God, what is this voice that I heard? Is it me or is it who? Until you tested it and you know it so surely, then you're willing to launch. And you have no more fear of rejection. Test out the ground. David took only those tools that he has tested. For him, it was his reliable old sling. And one thing I can assure you, David was a good shot. He didn't just depend on God. He didn't just depend on God and take something new. Some people think that David was a poor shot and it was God who helped him aim at Goliath's forehead. I will tell you that before that, he was a good shot. He was shooting at a lion and a bear. So he knows himself, and when his brother rejected him, he didn't feel anything. He didn't feel anything. The only statement he made is, say, what have I done? I've only said what is true. If you're unable to take rejection, that is the proportion that you haven't discovered yourself. If you discover yourself and you know your true tools, you're afraid to face a rejection that comes from the entire world. Because you know your stuff. If you don't know your stuff and you don't know yourself, you cannot face rejection. The more you know your tools, the more you're able to face rejection. The stronger you are. So that's the area to deal with, to overcome rejection. The other area that David has overcome, these are from his childhood, is the fear of death. Why? David has placed his lives in the hands of God many, many times. How many of us here have ever faced a bear or a lion? Do you know if you face a bear and a lion that you have endangered your life? But David was not afraid to die. I want you to know he was not afraid to die. There may be later certain things in his life that we're going to show when death almost hit him and the old fear tried to come back. When he was before the Philistines. But at this point, he had overcome the fear of death to a certain extent. And as he said here in chapter 17, verse 37. I want you to see how he overcame the fear of death. He says, the Lord who delivered me from the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear, he will deliver me. Do you see the same truth? David was like a little child who had surrendered to a greater power. He recognized no human being can preserve you from the bear. The lion, the snake, the crocodile. Do you know in the end no human being can save you but one Almighty God? Unless we believe in a higher power greater than our life, we will be only depending on our tools. Which is why you need to overcome both. If you only overcome one side, rejection, you become confident and then you still face that because sometimes your tools are not enough. Sometimes your own personality is not enough. And you recognize you got to rest your entire life on a higher power. And David, as he faced that bear, I could see how David overcame it the first time. And as he came across that bear, he was not born brave. I mean, he was not born Samson. He was not born with it. When he was small, straight away when he was born, he grabbed hold of somebody. Grabbed hold of cockroaches, snakes, all playthings for him. No. He would have grown up like anybody. But as he was a shepherd, I could see how he had a relationship with God. And when the bear came, he must have said a quick prayer. Say, God, it's my job to take care of the sheep. You help me and I will go to the bear. And as he came across this bear, it was not David versus the bear. No, my friend. It was David and God in cooperation versus the bear. And that day the bear didn't know what hit him. There was some power sort of dazing the bear. Wow. I could see almost like two angels with David. One angel caught hold of part of the bear. The other angel called out the other bear. So David just came in. Now I know there's some fight, of course. But if you ever study the history of bears, it is such a powerful creature that the bear has no known natural enemy except man. That's how powerful the bear can be. Huge and powerful. But God was there confusing the bear. And the bear, either the bear felt a bit dazed that day, or felt itself restrained a little bit. And I could see as David fought with the bear, come on, you don't expect the bear to just say, kill me. No, the bear was having a lamb. And as David drew near the bear, I could see David with his knife or sword. And as David was charging at this bear, perhaps David didn't see the bear's hand coming to the back. One scratch is enough to pull out his liver or heart. Perhaps as the bear was grabbing him at the back, dang, the angel put the hand there. And the bear scratched, eh? Different. As the bear said, eh? The bear died. But David has killed it. I would assume there was some measure. Believe me, there is some protection over David's life. I don't know which way and how God helped him, but I do know that the bear found out that he was fighting against more than David. And what about the lion? David says, when in verse 35, I went out after it, whether it be a lion or a bear, and struck it and delivered the lamb from its mouth. And when it rose against me, I caught it by its beard and struck and killed it. So you know what happens? Here is the story of the, let's say the lion. The lion caught hold of a lamb and the lion started running away. David says, number one, scene one. He ran after the lion. Hey, come back, you lion! Right? So we assume David ran like some of you dancing. Come back, you lion! And the lion turned around to see who is this small little fellow making a lot of noise. As the lion turned around, David opened his mouth. Now, don't tell me when David opened his mouth, he needed one hand. He was not Samson. How many hands do you need to open a lion's mouth? So as David was concentrating on opening the lion's mouth, don't tell me the lion's paws were just idle. I'm sure the lion would have taken his paws and if he could, he would have put them on David. And as David was opening the lion's mouth to take up the lamb, even if he was strong enough to somehow use a stick to open the lion's mouth, he needed the other hand to take out the lamb. And while he was concentrating on that, what was happening to the lion's paws? The lion's paws was coming this way. But that day the lion saw something different. When he scratched on David, why couldn't get through one? What kind of armor is this boy wearing? The lion tore. Which is why, did you notice that David did not say, "The Lord saved me from the mouth of the lion and the mouth of the bear, from the paws," because they are too fast with their hands for David to handle the hand. Somehow David trusted God to prevent that lion and the bear's paws from scratching and killing him. Saying, "God, we are one in cooperation. I take care of the lamb and the mouth, you take care of the legs." God said, "No problem, David." And David took the lamb, and God helped or prevented in some way the paws from killing David. One swipe from the lion is good enough. You will have been thrown a few feet away. The Lord, David recognized. You know why? As a lion came with his paws, David saw the hand of God. Somehow he either couldn't reach David. I don't know what happened, whether it grew shorter. Or something invisible was between David and the lion. And just before he reached David, something happened. So David said, "The Lord delivered me from the paw of the lion and the paw of the bear. And so he will deliver me from the paw of Goliath." The hand of God. That was sin too. But David was not going around. He was also an environmentalist. So he was not going around killing animals. After he has taken, he says here, in verse 35, after he freed the lamb, he must be just wanting to chase the lion away and go off. He says that, "When it rose against me," when the lion now charged on David, David just pulled it by the jungle and killed it. He says, "I caught it by the beard." That was the first time the lion ever had a human being touching his beard. Not all of us will be pulling jungle's lion's beard as a hobby. Pull the lion's beard and kill it. So David was no more afraid of dying. He had been close to death, and he had seen a supernatural hand protected him. He has surrendered his life to God. And so David says, "There's the Lord who preserves my life." And now as he says Goliath, all the others are afraid of dying. But David says, "Who is this Goliath to defy God's army?" He was not afraid of dying. And when David went out to face Goliath, his entire life was at stake. He may lose his life. David says, "No problem. Because his life is in the hands of God. If God wants him to die, there's nothing in the world that can prevent him from dying. But if God wants him to live, there's nothing in the world that can take his life away. That's the only way to handle the fear of the unknown and the fear of death. Self surrender, which David has done. You and I don't belong to ourselves anymore. We belong to God. Let's go to God in prayer.